No, this is fine. Okay, so this is mostly what I'll be speaking about is work with Carola Berger, Lance Dixon, Darren Ford, and David Kossauer on doing these precision calculations. So the outline of my talk is first I'm going to... This pen is a laser. Ah, oh, I thought the pen was a pen. Okay. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is next to leading order calculations at the LHC, the need for these things. I'll show you the wish list of what we need to do. There's a nice list of, call it marching orders, that we get from our experimental friends about what we're supposed to do. But then there's a little bit of trouble. These are not simple things to do. It takes considerable effort in order to follow the instructions. And then I'm going to show you a path to solving the problem, these on-shell methods, which most of you have probably not heard about. And it's a rewrite of quantum field theory. This is not the way we normally do things. It does not follow the textbooks. Michael Meads will have to rewrite his textbook at some point, I hope. Not you. Well, someone else will. Where's Tony? Okay, anyway. I'm going to show you some examples of state-of-the-art calculations, the examples of the types of calculations that we really want to do. These are very high-point calculations like this one. And then Matt Strassler said that I shouldn't give my usual superficial talk. So the second half of my talk, I'm going to give a blackboard lecture. Superficial. You know, it's like... Just float over the surface. I'm going to actually show you something. So I'm going to pick an example. In fact, it's the simplest example I can. It's a tree-level four-point calculation, just to show you how it's done. Now, if you follow what I do, you should then, for homework, go start working out endpoint calculations at tree level without any trouble, because it's the same algebra, the same ideas. Okay. So, okay, we're all very excited, right? We're having these Olympics. It's not very long before we have real data, not this simulated stuff. Anyway, here's just some typical example, and you look at it, and what do you see? Lots of particles. Well, we want some reliable predictions for lots of particles, and that's going to be the name of the game. There's many examples where it's very important to have reliable predictions. This is a very famous plot. A plot like this appears in the Atlas Technical Design Report. This is for the search for supersymmetry. So if you go look at the Technical Design Report, you'll see a plot which will give you, this is essentially missing energy here, and this is cross-section, and this is the prediction of the QCD and the standard model background. The missing energy given by this histogram, and then these black dots, that's what supersymmetry would do for you. And there you have it. It sits 10 times over the background, and therefore it's going to be completely trivial to discover supersymmetry at the LHC. You turn it on, and there it is. One little problem, this plot is completely wrong. And the problem is it's based on the wrong physics. It's based on soft physics. We're talking about hard scattering. Look at the scale here. That looks pretty hard to me. What we need are the matrix elements. And there's a program now which does this. This is based on leading order matrix elements, or the tree-level matrix elements. And it's a very nice program. It does lots of particles. It's very efficient. And anyway, what you get is this red plot here. This is for the standard model background. And now you see it's not as simple as people have said. It's a lot more problematic. But let me ask you, suppose that we go to the LHC and we find that the data lies on top of these black dots and Alpjohn still stays where it is. And then what are we going to say? And I can already save people a lot of time. We can say that we should have calculated next to leading order, because you can't tell what this means. The leading order predictions are not good enough. This is what we need to calculate. This is 7 points. Okay? Oh, I see I have a little glitch down there. Huh. Oh, roaming, that's what I'm doing. Hold on, just let's take a little break here. Go away. Okay. Okay, so here's another example. So we've discovered the Higgs boson, and we want to know its coupling to weak bosons. So you can measure the rapidity against the cross-section. That's very nice. You get a very nice signal. But the problem is that, you see, if you're doing only leading order, the background is very uncertain, and you really don't know what you're doing. Now, of course, it'll be happy days when Higgs plus two jets is a background. It's not the physics you're interested in, it's the background. But still, this is an example of why you need a next to leading order calculation. And there's many more examples. You can go through a very long list. So this is the list from Lazouche 2005. This is, in fact, not the complete list of interesting processes that need to be done. None of these have been done. This is, in fact, just the list of interesting processes that people think they might be able to do. The true list is a bit longer. These are all processes that involve six legs. Okay, and this is a very important problem that a lot of people have devoted serious time and attention to. But it's been, at least over the past decade, if you look at the progress, it has not been so brilliant. But I'm going to talk about a new approach to this problem. Well, there's numerical approaches that people have been pushing by these people. I won't be talking about that. I'm going to talk about an analytic approach, which I think is the much more promising approach for dealing with these problems, an analytic approach. In general, analytics is better if you can do it, because then you have an expression that you can study, and it's much easier to do things properly and correctly with analytic approaches. And I'm going to show you that you can go very far with the analytic approach. So what's the problem? Okay, why is this? This is a technical problem. Why can't we do these processes? Our experimental colleagues are telling us this is what we need to do, and the question is, why can't we do it? And the problem is very simple. This is the very simplest integral, the box integral. So this is child's play for people. You take out your computer and you blast away at this, but still it illustrates what the problem is. This is a tensor integral, and we just need to do the integral, right? It's a math problem. So how are we going to do it? Well, you open up the literature and you find the Passerino-Veltman reduction. It's an algebraic way of dealing with this in terms of a basis of scalar integrals. Now, the literature is full of methods, but they're all pretty much the same. This is what happens. Okay, so it's one integral. There's thousands you have to do, and this is the mess you get. And this is not a question of, oh, well, I have a big enough computer. My computer is bigger than yours, and I can do it. The problem is that this, in general, is not numerically stable. And it takes considerable effort to make this thing useful, because there are singularities. If you took out your microscope, you'd find that there's determinants in the denominator, spurious singularities that cause numerical instabilities when you try to integrate over phase space. Okay. Now, what do we need? Well, whatever method you have, it better be numerically stable. Saying that you have done this process, and then you plug it into a computer program, and the thing is unstable, or it runs too slow, or it's not useful to get numbers out, well then, okay, you haven't done it. The other thing is we want to solve problems like this one. This is two steps beyond where we can go, right? We don't want to fool around, right? We're all growing, at least I'm growing old, maybe some of you aren't, but we're growing old. We got to solve the important problems like this one. So you want to have a method that as you increase the number of legs, if I add another leg here, another gluon, another quark, the thing doesn't explode on me, that the thing behaves nicely. Now, normally, in field theory, you'll find statements about factorial growth of complexity, factorial growth in Feynman diagrams, and all that other stuff. If you hit factorial growth, you're dead, right? So those statements better be wrong, okay? And then what you need is a general solution. If you solve, let's say, one process, that solution had better carry over to other processes. If it doesn't, then you probably have not made as much progress as you think you have. And the other thing is you need something that can be automated. That at the end, no matter how good your technique is, no matter how wonderful and brilliant you think you are, there are lots and lots of sub-processes. There's lots of bookkeeping you have to keep track of. Even if you had the perfect method, but you could somehow just write down this answer without actually calculating it, you still have to do a lot of bookkeeping, all the different possible ways that the color can flow through here and all the different sets of particles you can have. So you need some kind of automation in it. Yes? No, there's some people, it depends who does it, but the best way of doing numerical is semi-numerical. That you actually do it analytically, but you have analytic formulas. You don't actually do the integrals numerically. That's a really bad idea in general, especially in Minkowski space. But what you do is you mix analytics with numerics in order to not run into the problems of actually carrying out the integrations, you know, the D4P, but you do the, in a sense, you're doing the Passerino-Veltman, this kind of crap you deal with numerically, but the actual polylogs that appear you deal with analytically. That's the best way of doing it numerically or semi-numerically. That's the this approach of wherever they got lost somewhere there. Ellis, Giel, Dundereggi. Actually, it's Giel and Glover. But as yet, pure numerical approaches have not gotten to the state of the art yet. Okay, so what we really want, this is what we're dreaming of, some kind of technique that just, it doesn't solve this problem, it solves problems as you increase the number of legs, the approach still continues to work. And I like analytic expressions that fit on a page. Of course, you have to redefine exactly what a page means, but you want something that you can look at. And the power of being able to look at an expression is extremely important to go on and understand the structures and to exploit the structures that you find in the amplitudes. So here's just a list of some of the progress. So it's these on-shell methods that I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to amplitudes with more than 5 legs, n legs, done all at once. There's various improvements. There's various improvements for dealing with the logarithmic parts. But anyway, the key thing that I'm going to emphasize in this talk is there's a modest growth in complexity as the number of legs increases. And you don't get these numerical instabilities in the expressions, very mild singularities, so the phase space integrals are under control. So so first thing I want to talk about is a little bit about new ideas, exploiting structures that you find inside the amplitude. So amplitudes are not a big mess. They have a structure in them, even though they might look like a mess, but they have a structure in them that you can exploit. And that structure is due to Witten. It's exposed by twisters and this Penrose transform. So first, spinners. We all know what spinners are. Well, spinners are really cool things. You want to write everything that you can in terms of spinners. So even polarizations. The polarization vectors you want to write in terms of these spinner inner products. This is called spinner helicity. It's sometimes called Chinese magic. It's very magical. You're writing a spin one object in terms of products of spin one half objects. This K here is the momentum of the gluon you're talking about. So first I'm going to start talking about massless. Okay, so it's a little simpler to talk about massless, but then I'll explain that a lot of the things I'm talking about, it doesn't really matter if it's massless or massive. So these are massless spinners, these are vial spinners. There it is in two component notation. We like these angle brackets here. So these are just spinner inner products. You'll find this in the back of Peskin and Schroeder. It's nothing but the spinner inner product with a helicity projection. It's the square root of a Lorentz inner product. We have two types. There's the positive helicity and the negative helicity ones. So the negative helicity, the inner product, we write in terms of angle, the positive helicity in terms of these squares. And this is the Penrose transform here. Now, why you actually want to do this is not so obvious until you actually look at the results that you get. This Penrose transform is a little bit peculiar. It's a Fourier transform. Actually, it would have been a Fourier transform if I put an I there. But anyway, it's just a Fourier transform, but it's not with respect to momenta, it's with respect to spinners. And it's with respect to one of the spinners, only with respect to the negative helicity spinners. Now, that's very peculiar, because you're screwing up parity with this transform. And you'd either have to be an idiot or a genius to do this. I guess if you're a genius, you do it. And the thing that's really remarkable about Witten is the identification of structures in the amplitudes, QCD amplitudes. Have structures in them. Actually, he was talking about N equals 4 super Yang mils, but at tree level, it doesn't really make any difference. So he identified structures, which I'll talk a little bit about on the next transparency, in the QCD amplitudes. He used that to find a mapping to topological string theory. It's really something absolutely amazing. What does QCD amplitudes, what do they have to do with topological string theory? Well, I don't really know, but I do know that it's very important. It's something very essential, even though we don't fully understand the consequences of this, why these amplitudes have this duality to the topological string, and even something more basic, we don't understand why they have these structures that Witten conjectured. So this really amazing conjecture of Witten, which is true, even though there isn't really a general proof of it, but anyway, it's true. Is that if you take a QCD amplitude, actually we're talking about N equals 4 super Yang mils, if you put in the loop or the number of loops, okay, then we should talk about N equals 4 super Yang mils, but that's actually a minor point. It's really QCD, it works pretty much the same way, and he said that the amplitudes have support on curves of degree D. So there's some curve in twister space. So it's after the Fourier transform, you can see this. It's delta function support. So what that means is in twister space, these are the external points here. I take this point, I move it off the curve, the amplitude vanishes. I put it on the curve, you're sitting on top of the delta function. And after some amount of time, some number of months, people realized that there were two pictures. You see, there's this connected picture. This is, let's say, a degree 3 curve that you see in twister space. So that would be four negative helicities. So let's say 4 negative helicities. Loop order is 0. You'd get a degree 3 curve. And where do these curves come from? I don't know, but they're definitely there. You can construct a set of differential operators to prove that these curves are there. There's also this disconnected picture, which turns out to be the more useful one for practical purposes. This is the much more interesting one, without any question. This is the one that's much more practical, at least so far. This is the disconnected picture. So this is a degeneration of this. So there's actually even a sum in here. You have to sum over these different intersecting lines. These intersecting lines, you might say, oh, look, see, Witten was wrong. But no, Witten is never wrong. You see, this is a degenerate case. If you take a curve of let's say, degree 2, and you degenerate it, you can, in the degenerate limit, you can get intersecting lines. So this is actually part of the same picture. These intersecting lines are really very amazing because they tell us, if you have the right intuition, you say, well, in twister space, the amplitude has support, or terms in the amplitude have support on these intersecting lines. What can that possibly mean back in the original field theory, back in momentum space? And you decide that it has to be some kind of a factorization property in terms of these maximally helicity-violating amplitudes. That's the two negative helicities are represented by straight lines. These intersecting guys need to be interpreted in terms of a new set of vertices. These are called MHV vertices. I'm actually not going to talk much about that. It's really something pretty fascinating that you can do this. And even more amazingly, it just works. It's done by guesswork. There's actually lots of proofs of it now. Okay. Now, what do these curves mean for us? Okay, so you say, well, all this is all very nice. But you see, the key thing, it's not the twisters, it's not the curves. The key thing is the simplicity. If there are such structures in the amplitude has to be a heck of a lot simpler than we thought. That's the key point. And if you know it's simple, then you can go very far. You see, in this game, the one thing you really need more than anything is faith that, in fact, the answers are simple. Once you have that, then you can really go far. And that's the key thing that the twisters give us, this idea of simplicity, that there's these simple building blocks in terms of these maximally helicity-violating amplitudes. Okay. So, first, let me say a little bit about why the Feynman diagrams are clumsy. What's the problem? So the problem isn't what you think it is. So you might think, oh, it's because you have these nasty integrals, right? And what I need to do is go ahead and find a better way to do integrals. But I can assure you, if you're talking about integrals, better ways of doing integrals, you're already in big trouble. You have to go back to the basics of field theory and ask, how is field theory constructed? And see, the problem, it's kind of a line one problem that's very basic to the way that we think about field theory, that any textbook will tell you about how to do scattering amplitudes. They will say that you have to go off shell because you can't do it on shell. It just won't work. Okay, and see, okay, tree level, you can see this leg here is, that leg is off shell. Okay, but you say, well, right here, okay, there's a loop integral. It's obvious the thing is off shell because you have to integrate over all momenta. But I'm saying that that's what the problem is. What we need is a formalism that's entirely based on on-shell quantities, that you never touch an off-shell quantity. Off-shell should be banished. And the wisdom of what we're going to do and how we're going to think about it is a very beautiful quote from Schwinger. One of the most remarkable discoveries in elementary particle physics has been that of the existence of the complex plane. The trick is going to be the following. If we understand the poles and we understand the cuts, we have the function. And that's the most efficient way of dealing with it. Inherently, it's the most efficient way of dealing with it, because what's an amplitude? It's an analytic function that has poles and cuts. If you have a way of going after the poles and cuts directly and constructing the function with the correct poles and cuts, then in fact, you win.
Now,
well, it's the bootstrap or the S matrix, the analytic S matrix on steroids. That's what it is. We're going to put it on steroids. Okay. And the way that we're going to do it is very simple. You see, if you have multiple complex variables, then what does complex variable theory tell you about it? The answer is not much. So if I have a very if I have some complicated, this thing is a complicated analytic function of many variables, right? So I want to apply complex variable theory to it. Well, good luck. If you want to solve the problem, what you need is one complex variable. Because if you take one complex variable, it's basic complex analysis that will give you what the function is. So the whole trick is going to be exactly that. We're going to try to rewrite things so we only have one complex variable that will allow us to construct the function, not multiple complex variables. And these Anschel formalisms, they're designed specifically in mind with trying to exploit the analytic properties of amplitudes. So what's a bit curious is the solution for doing an Anschel formalism first came at loop level. You say, wait a second, how can you do loop level without doing tree level? And yes, it's true, we did not understand how to do tree level. We just needed a little bit of inspiration. We needed Witten to help us. And the solution at tree level is there's now two very nice solutions, the MHV vertices, and the much more powerful and general one is Anschel recursion. And this is what I'm going to talk about. At the end of the talk, I'm going to show you an example of how this works. And what's really brilliant about this is if you look at the paper, you'll see that it contains nothing. Almost content-free, the paper, and that's why it's so powerful, because it's very, very simple. There's a few things about complex variable theory and a few comments about the basic properties of any scattering amplitude, and lo and behold, you can now construct amplitudes basically with a factory. Okay. And to deal with the loop level, so the problem that we're most interested for the LHC, the reason why trees are less interesting is because it's a solved problem. People have computer programs based on various techniques that solve the tree level problem, like that AlpGen program. Right, that's a solution. The problem we don't have solved for the LHC, that's the loop level. So it's this Anschel bootstrap. It combines these two ideas. So first, let's talk about the loops. Okay, so the unitarity method. Well, we all know how to do unitarity. Right? It's an elementary property of field theory. So you can consider two particle cuts. Let's say there's just two loops for amusement. It could be three particle cuts. Okay, the trick in all this is how you're supposed to take this information on the unitarity and construct analytic functions with multiple kinematic variables. So the problem of how to do two-to-two scattering, that was solved in the 60s, the Mandelstam representation or double dispersion relation. The question is, how do you do multiple variables? Well, that's exactly what this unitarity method is about. The key trick, what we know that people in the 60s did not know, is we know QCD, we understand a lot about Feynman diagrams. We understand that there's an underlying Feynman diagram structure, and that allows you to construct amplitudes, general amplitudes from the unitarity cuts. Here's a very cool trick. This is very neat. It's this concept of generalized unitarity. So here you see, put this Anschel. See, there's an Anschel formalism. This leg is Anschel, that leg's Anschel, that's Anschel, that's Anschel. But here, this generalized unitarity, we're going to put all four guys Anschel. Now you're going to ask me, what does it mean in terms of the imaginary part? You know, the usual thing from unitarity. It doesn't mean anything. It just means that these propagators are present. And the very cool trick is, let's count. There's an Anschel condition here. One, two, three, four. Four Anschel conditions. How many loop momenta do we have if we're in four dimensions? Four, right? That means you have enough delta functions to freeze the integral. So this becomes a trivial algebraic problem. And in fact, it's in this class, in this category of what I would call a perfect calculation. You can just write down the answer as a product of trees, and then you plug in certain values of the loop momenta. It doesn't get any better than that. Very cool observation from Biro Cacciazzo and Feng that this quadruple cut freezes the integral. So, in fact, in any theory, it doesn't matter what you're talking about, this is always true. The coefficient of any box integral is trivial to get.
Okay. Yes?
Yeah, the coefficient. Because the basis of integrals is known. Yeah. So it's the coefficient of the integral that's the only thing you're interested in. Right? Yeah, so what I mean by trivial, I meant the coefficient is trivial, but once you have the coefficient, you're done. Because the integral has been known for, 20 years? Which integral? Oh, no, which one? This one? No. No, I mean, this is the tensor. No, it's because this is not a gauge invariant. This is just a piece of garbage. Garbage in, garbage out. No, there's no simplification. There's no special. None of this crap. Because you see, this thing here is not a physical thing. The object we're interested in is amplitude. So you see what appears in the cuts, it's not specific integrals. It's not a specific tensor integral. It's these are gauge invariant objects here, gauge invariant tree amplitudes. And that point is really important because you see the problem with normal formalisms is it's a scalar box integral. It's a scalar box integral. It would be equivalent to this thing here, except there's a 1 here, not a 10. So those are known integrals that you can just look up. It gives you the coefficient of the box integral. Okay. It works very generally, whether it's massless, massive, the same basic idea works. It's very cool, this thing. Anyway, now there's also triangle and bubble integrals. So there's a theorem that says that any amplitude in four dimensions can be expressed in terms of boxes, bubbles, and triangles. So boxes are solved trivially. There's bubble and triangle integrals. Those are still harder, but there's been quite a bit of progress on this, and lots of explicit examples where people have worked out state-of-the-art or beyond what was state-of-the-art in QCD. So almost 10 years ago. We felt in our bones that it was the analytic structure. Right? The key for solving these problems is we had to understand the analytic structure. Using the poles and cuts, we should be able to construct the function. So this was the process we were looking at. Actually, we were looking in those days, LEP was running, so we were thinking about E plus E minus. But it's the same process. Okay, now you just cross it over, and we're talking about PP, W, or a Z, and two partons. And the way that we attack this problem is we use the unitarity method, we use helicity, okay, and this gave us all the logs and all the polylogs. There's a key restriction here. See, in dimensional regularization, this is not in four dimensions. It's not in four dimensions. You're not allowed to use helicity. So you make an error. The error is localized to rational functions, not to logs and polylogs. So the way we got the rational functions is we guessed them. Okay. Now that's a very unpleasant way to do things. So the idea is you know what the poles are. You see the general property of any quantum field theory is that it has to factorize on the poles. As any intermediate line goes on shell, the thing has to factorize into amplitudes. So this is a gauge invariant statement. This is not it is a property of Feynman diagrams. Feynman diagrams do something like this, but the key thing for us is this is a property of amplitudes. So if we knew all the poles in the amplitude, And it's this problem, if you know all the poles, go find the function. Okay, and the fundamental problem is there are many kinematic variables here, and like I said, complex variable theory with multiple kinematic variables is not as useful as one might hope. And what stopped us, the reason why this sat for 10 years, is the place we got stuck is guessing is not a good technique. So if I go to the next harder one or some other process, you can't do it systematically. You have to start guessing these things, and that can be extremely painful. It's very difficult to find the functions with the desired properties. And the solution to this problem is this paper of Brito, Cacciazzo, Feng, and Witten. It's a very beautiful paper. All of you should read it. I think it really changes the way that we think about perturbation theory because of its incredible simplicity. So, the basic idea is we consider a shifted amplitude. Now, I'm not going to explain where this came from because if I did, it would be extremely convoluted. It's actually a very long story having to do with N equals 4 super Yang Mills, infrared singularities, and some kind of various contortions. But at the end, Brito, Cacciazzo, and Feng, they wrote down an on-shell recursion relation, and then together with Witten, they explained the recursion relation in terms of this very simple idea. So let's consider an amplitude. And what we're going to do is we're going to shift the momentum and introduce one complex variable, right? Remember I said the key is you got to have one complex variable in order to do complex variable theory. So this shift here has some really interesting properties. First thing is, notice that if I shift leg number one and some other leg, let me make it leg number n, just one other leg. So there's two special legs, one and n. I shift this guy like so, and I shift this guy with the opposite sign. So first thing is notice momentum conservation still works. The next thing is you can go home and in a couple minutes you'll be able to demonstrate that in fact p squared is equal to zero. At the end I'll explain this in a little more detail. So this thing still stays on shell. That's the key. Right? If momentum conservation didn't work, or we went off-shell, we would be in trouble. Because off-shell, things will not be gauge invariant, things will not be simple. So the extra thing, you say, okay, why didn't people do this before? Well, okay, that I don't know. But the notice that this momentum here is now complex. This is a complex parameter, this is now complex. Now, suppose I have an analytic function. I have an analytic function of this variable z. What happens, right? I get an urge to do a contour integral, right? If you have an analytic function, what do you want to do? You do a contour integral. You want to integrate around here, and we know from the residue function, from the residue theorem, that we can construct the complete amplitude just by knowing the residues. But you see, we know the residues because of this nice factorization property that any amplitude is supposed to have. Okay. Now, this is, in fact, what I'll talk about in my Blackboard lecture, assuming I have enough time, which I may not. How much time do I have? Oh, okay. Okay. Well, anyway, let me move along. Okay, so this is the way that the loop amplitudes get constructed. Same idea. We're going to follow the shift. This analytic function of z, we can determine first the polylogs. We use this unitarity method. And then we have a set of poles. To do the poles, we use this on-shell recursion. And then it could be a technical problem. You see, to use Cauchy's theorem, you need to know what's going off out here. If z goes to infinity, there may be an extra contribution. It turns out at loop level, this can be more of a problem. So you need to determine this, and the trickery is to make use of the freedom that we can choose any sets of legs. See, I chose two special legs. Well, there's lots of legs I can choose. And you can capture the missing analytic information, what's happening off at z equals infinity, by setting up another recursion relation. Now, the loop level is a lot trickier than we hoped it would be. At the technical level, it's as powerful as we had hoped, but the problem is conceptually. There's a lot of landmines as you do this. Okay. So the first thing, okay, well, that's kind of obvious, is branch cuts. Well, okay, never mind those. But there's a problem that happens that's very peculiar. So let's first of all, like this one here, you see there's this double pole that can happen. So what are the textbooks? Open up Michael's textbook, and what will it tell you? Maybe it doesn't say this, I don't know, but it should say that you can't have double poles. Double poles don't mean anything because it doesn't correspond to the physical propagation of a particle. Well, those statements are wrong when you're dealing with complex momenta. You see, if you have real momenta, this is a single pole, because this guy is the complex conjugate of that guy, and it's just a pure phase. See, this ratio, you get a pure phase here. So you get a phase times a single pole, but if you have complex momenta, this guy does not have to vanish when that guy vanishes, and you get a double pole. So the books are wrong. Very peculiar, at least for complex momenta. Of course, they weren't thinking about complex momenta. Then there's this very peculiar thing, this, we call them unreal poles. So you see, Cauchy's theorem, and unfortunately, it doesn't tell you sum over the poles that you know and ignore the one that you don't know. It tells you you have to sum over all of them. Now, if you encounter one of these unreal poles, you can wind up with a pole in the complex plane where there's no theorems that tell you what to do. And to make matters worse, if you investigate the structure of these poles, you discover that you actually don't understand them. Okay. And that's a very annoying problem. Yeah.
Are you saying that this actually throws humans away from that?
No, what I'm saying is that I don't know what these are. You see, no, this doesn't, you know, I wouldn't interpret it. I wouldn't interpret it that way. I mean, you know, you have an analytic function, right? And it has certain poles that I don't understand. You know, that's all I'm saying, okay? You know, nothing about probing anything. It's just that, you know, it's an analytic function. There's certain poles. Some of them I understand, or most of them I understand, because they correspond to a completely standard field theory, just the poles we know and love. But then there's another set of poles which are not understood. Okay, it shouldn't be taken to be anything more than that. It doesn't. I'm not saying we can't understand them. I'm not saying there's. I mean, they correspond to the normal poles that you find in an experiment. These guys, you can't sit on top of. You can't sit on top of this pole in an experiment. On the other hand, you know, on the other hand, I think that they're just as physical because, you see, an analytic function, the amplitude is a physical quantity. Its poles correspond to physical things, and the function, if you take away one pole, it's the wrong answer. So there's no question that this thing is physical, but I don't know what the physical meaning of it is. So it's just a problem in field theory. So what do you do when you don't understand something? And the answer is you avoid it. They do not appear in the tree level. Actually, what's interesting is it's not completely obvious that they do not appear, but you can demonstrate that they don't appear. It requires a little work to demonstrate that this doesn't happen. This is only a property of loop level. Okay, and this is a very annoying property. Okay, but you see, we don't have to understand everything about this, and I think this is clearly a very important problem. Someone needs to go and understand what the heck these things are doing in the complex plane. And like I say, I assure you they're physical because take them away and it's the wrong answer. So clearly it's physical, and somebody needs to understand that. But at this point in time, there's a much better way of dealing with it, which is you jump around them. You see, we have freedom. We make use of our freedom. See, here I've picked legs 1 and n. So let me pick some other legs. All I need to know is where these things are. I don't need to know what their actual residues are. I just need to know where they are. If I know where they are, I can avoid them. Okay, and that's the trick. That's what this Anshel bootstrap deals with, these problems. Okay. Now, from the technical point of view, right, so to actually construct something, these are not problems. These are just annoyances. Right? So there's two issues. One is theoretical, like how exactly do we do it? And the other one is to actually carry it out. None of this stuff affects actually carrying it out. Or there's only a very mild effect because you have to dance around them. So let me show you how to do 5 points. So 5 points, not very long ago, was very complicated. Even today, this is considered state of the art. So let's do a 5-point calculation. Let's talk about the rational functions. So the logarithms, that was dealt with a very long time ago. But these rational functions are the problem, or were the problem. So let's see how to do the computation. So what happens is you find one non-vanishing diagram at 5 points. We're going to talk about disilicity configuration for pure glue. We like glue not because of the great phenomenology, but we like it because it's a good test case to work out. So if you look at disilicity configuration here, what you find is one recursive diagram, so it's like one Feynman diagram. This thing, this lower point loop amplitude here, this L here represents the loop amplitude. It's the rational function part of it. This part you know because you wouldn't be looking at 5 points unless you already knew the 4 points, right? So this you know, you just look it up. This is a simple tree-level vertex. It takes a couple minutes of algebra to do this. I'll do some analogous algebra at tree level for you at the end. And then there is some issue having to do with some overlap. When you do the unitarity cuts, there's some rational functions that are caught in there, and there's some overlap contributions, so you have to calculate some residues. So these overlap, these double count diagrams, the way you do it is you just extract some residues from pieces, from these pieces that contain the logarithms. Okay, and that's basically the entire calculation. If I had a little more time or patience, I would actually show you every step of algebra, and that's actually not a threat, it's just a 15 minutes or so. Okay, so to show you we're not fooling around here, here's a 6-point example. So this is the rational function part. Okay, it happens to be a scalar in a loop, and there's some technical reason why it's nice to decompose QCD amplitudes into supersymmetric, n equals 4 supersymmetry, n equals 1, and then there's a scalar piece. It's this guy, which was the annoying one, and this rational function piece. So there it is. And you see, okay, there it is, it's compact, it fits on a page. Okay, it's not always going to be like that, but what is true is if you look through the set of spurious singularities, there's some funny singularities. If you see there's some denominator here, for example, these are very mild. These will not trouble us with the numerical integration. Okay, so to show you that we're not really playing games here. We're trying to go after these high point amplitudes. Okay, I'm not going to show you the analytic expressions, but these are just numbers obtained from the analytic expressions. You take the analytic expression, plug in a point in phase space, some point in phase space, extract some numbers, you know, just to demonstrate that you have some numbers, and you can also compare to the semi-numerical people, so at 6 points. 7 points, 8 points. If you want 9 points, no problem, I'll give it to you tomorrow because it's a compact analytic expression and it satisfies this key condition, modest complexity as the number of legs increases. So we did 6, the next day we could do 7, the day after we could do 8. It has very modest growth. All this stuff that you know about factorial growth of the complexity of perturbation theory is just wrong. It's just not true. And the origin of that complexity has to do with the fact that we're calculating gauge non-invariant objects in general. Here we're only working with gauge invariant objects. Okay. What's that? Well, it's just a growth in the number of Feynman diagrams. You know, there's two things. My words were chosen very carefully. I said growth in complexity of the diagrams. That statement, it's true, but irrelevant. You see, diagrams are not important. So here's an example of factorial growth. So for entertainment, you see, let's go to 8 points. So how many diagrams are there at 8 points? There happens to be about 3 million Feynman diagrams. Actually, this number is kind of irrelevant. If you had enough money, you could deal with this. The problem is this one diagram. So this guy, this is where the problem is. This is what dominates the calculation. Okay. Now, the reason why we could do this is because we didn't calculate anything like this. We use the 7 points, which use the 6 points, which use the 5 points, in a recursive way, so that all the simplification that you've already built in at the lower point, you feed into the higher point. So in fact, it's only a polynomial growth. And actually something very important. It's even right, because you see, we can compare, at least at 6 points, we can compare to others who use the semi-numerical methods. So Ellis, Gilles, Zondereggi, they worked out the 6-point amplitude. Anyway, up to some phase conventions, we agree numerically. Some of it we did first, some of it they did first, so it's actually completely independent in that sense. No. It's going to be a long time before semi-numerical will get up to 7 points. Yes. It's actually, yes. So this guy here, to do all of this, takes about 30 milliseconds for us because it's compact analytic expression. The semi-numericals, it's measured in seconds, so it's about a factor of 1,000. There's about a factor of 1,000 difference in the speed. The semi-numerical people are going to be challenged, I think, at 6 points and beyond. But okay, everyone should do it the way they want. Okay, so what needs to be done? Well, the key thing is that wish list. In fact, the key process is this one with one more leg. That's the one. That's the next thing to be done. And then once we do one more leg, I hope we'll move upwards. So that's, in fact, the one for the supersymmetry search. If you can do the Z plus 4 partons. Okay, so that's the most important thing. Automation is something very important. We need manpower and strong people to help us on a lot of these things. Now, I've been talking about amplitudes. Amplitudes are not physics. Amplitudes are, in fact, infrared divergent in general. You have to assemble the full cross section. There's a technology for doing this. Catani Seymour is the most famous one. It's the most popular one. But that still requires some serious work to put it all together. And also, what's really hard in this game is you have to get the right answer. Right? That takes a lot of work. The things I've been showing you, so far, no one has looked at massive loops. So if you put a top quark in the loop, well, I don't know if it'll work. No one has looked at it. There's lots of steps. You see these, like the general understanding of the unreal poles. We deal with it by dancing around them. Right? But someone should sit down and figure out what the heck is going on with these things. There's other analytic properties that we understand heuristically, or we understand what to do, but there's no first principle derivation of it. I think people always ask about the connection of the Lagrangian. A lot of this stuff is done by just writing down the answer, writing down the method without derivation. You just understand what you're supposed to do, but in fact, it's nice to hook up to the Lagrangian in some kind of systematic way. There's already some work on that, at least at tree level. Just a couple words about other applications, which I won't be able to talk about. But anyway, these on-shell methods, one of the first places we applied it was these two-loop computations. Something I really like, and I probably should not work on as much as I do, given the importance of the LHC, is n equals 4 super Yang mills. You can do things to all loop orders. It's very cool. And then there's applications to gravity, some basic things in gravity, which I'm happy to discuss afterwards, I think are not correct. And we have the technology to do high loop calculations to confirm this. Okay, anyway, so for the LHC, we need some bold action. If you look at that list I showed you, and you look at the rate of progress, there's this wish list, right? And you look at the rate of progress, you realize that we're going to be in trouble. So we need some bold action, hard work, and I hope some of you will be interested in attacking these problems. These are very important problems for the LHC. You don't build billion-dollar experiments and then go, oops, I don't know what the data means. Right? There's something very important to be done here. I showed you an approach, this on-shell bootstrap approach. It makes use of the analytic properties of amplitudes. Show you we're not playing games. There's results for n greater than or equal to 6 gluons at one loop. Numerical results up to 8. And the case we're really interested for phenomenology is you put a W boson, a Z boson on the outside, and the technology directly applies. There's really no difference as far as the technology is concerned. But there's important issues. We have to think about automation, doing massive loops, if we're ever going to do a top loop or bottom, construction of or actually anything electroweak, of course, we need to be able to do masses. The construction of the physical cross sections, that will require some serious work. But anyway, this experimenter's wish list awaits us. Questions? Yeah, let me, I'm probably going to need a little more time if that's okay. I don't know if, well, I can get started, and then you get bored, you walk out. It's okay. So, I just want to show you how this on-shell recursion works. You know, it's easy to, you know, kind of wave your hands and say, oh, it works like this, it works like that. But it might be good if you could actually see how it works. And also to see that it is as simple as what I say, that the ideas behind it are just basic facts about field theory and complex variable theory. So the first thing is we're going to use spinner helicity. Okay, so this guy here is a reference momentum. This reference momentum, it drops out of a final gauge invariant answer, so I can choose it to be anything I want. I'm actually not going to really use this. This line is just to say we're going to rewrite everything in terms of spinners. Okay, and the reason why I'm picking spinners is because if I don't pick spinners, I can't fit it on the blackboard. So I need to use the spinner helicity so that I can deliver my lecture. But it's really not of any fundamental consequence, because the basic ideas are just standard ideas of quantum field theory that applies to any theory. So if I use spinner helicity, my amplitude is a function of two kinds of spinners. These are the positive helicity. And these are the negative helicity. and I had this notation, epsilon AB lambda A lambda B is equal to, so this is in terms of the spinners, is equal to AB. Okay, and this is the notation that I'm going to be using. So what I'm going to do is make a shift. So I have some amplitude. And I'm going to pick two legs in this amplitude, special legs. Okay. And these special legs, I'm going to shift. And the purpose of the shift is to get one complex variable into it. So I'm going to take ki. So by I mean a specific one. I don't mean like shift all of them. I mean you shift a specific one. Okay, kj of z equals, so this is by definition, it's kj mu plus z over 2 I minus gamma mu j minus. Okay, so what this shift does for you is first it leaves ki square of z. Well, we can just work that fellow out. So that's k square. So we're going to take these to be massless. Why do I take them to be massless? It's because massless is simpler to deal with, especially on a blackboard. But it's not, it's actually not essential. So this thing squares, so it's supposed to square here, and then minus z over 2 I minus ki slash j minus, and then plus z over 2 squared, and then I gamma mu, well, I gamma mu j this thing squared. Okay, this thing is equal to 0. This thing is equal to 0 by the Dirac equation, so that's 0. And this thing is equal to 0 by a Fiertz identity. Okay, so you can go home and check your Fiertz identity, and you'll see that the square of this thing is 0. Okay, so this shift has been designed very carefully. It maintains the on-shell condition. Okay. So now what we do is we use Cauchy's theorem. Okay. So this is not exactly the way that Guido Cacciazzo, Feng, and Witten described it, but it follows basically their logic. So Cauchy's theorem, right? So Cauchy's theorem says that if I take my amplitude, you see my amplitude here, if I apply the shift to this shift here, I can rewrite that, actually that same shift I can rewrite in two component notation, lambda I plus z lambda j. Lambda j twiddle goes to lambda j minus z lambda I twiddle. Okay, this is a shift of the angle bracket. There's the angle bracket. The square bracket, so that's the opposite helicity. This is shift of square bracket. If you just kind of translate it. Yeah, I'm sorry that I'm moving a little faster than I wanted to. Okay, so what happens, if you make that shift, you see, you apply this shift, that momentum shift or the spinner shift, what happens is this amplitude becomes a function of z and then some spinners. So we're interested in this property, a of z. It's now a function of this complex variable here. There's other complex variables, but let's consider them to be constants as far as the problem is concerned. So let me consider the following contour integral. a of z divided by z dz, and I integrate this thing like so. Now this thing here is a happy analytic function. We're at tree level. Let's make it a tree level. If we're at tree level, then this function can only have poles. All right. Now let's assume, I'm just going to assume this, and this is something that we can prove later, which I'm not going to do for you for lack of time. But anyway, let's just assume that a of z goes to infinity is equal to zero. So then this is a very nice integral. I can do it. Most integrals I can't do. This one I can do. It's zero. And then we just apply the residue theorem. So the residue theorem says that I have to sum over all the residues. There's one at z equals zero. Okay, that residue, if I get an equation that says zero is equal to a at z equals zero plus the sum over the poles, alpha, residue, alpha, a of z over z. Okay, this guy here, that's what we want, right? Because, you know, it's very nice to have this new parameter, but last I checked, we don't actually do experiments with complex momenta. We do them with real momenta. So we need to set z equals zero. This guy is the physical amplitude. So this is the physical amplitude. Right? But you see, we have an equation which relates it to residues, sums over poles. And this is the key recursion relation, which I will explain in a little more detail. It's the sum over these residues of a of z over z. Okay? Now, let's suppose that we know that this is true. Then, from basic complex variable theory, we know that a of z is equal to the sum over some constants. So these constants depend on momenta, they depend on spinners. They could be complicated objects, but they're constants as far as this variable z is concerned, z minus z alpha. So the function has to look like this, because any analytic function that vanishes off at z equals zero, unless it's a constant, but anyway, if it has poles, well then it's a sum over poles. There's only single poles, because the textbooks are right for tree level. At tree level, there's only single poles. So this is what the function has to look like. Okay, so we're going to use, so these are the two key facts. Fact number one, Cauchy's theorem. Fact number two is that it's an analytic function that only has poles. And in fact, we know what the poles are because amplitudes always factorize on their poles. So let's put A, I, B. Okay, B plus 1, A minus 1. And then there's a propagator here, PAB square. So by PAB, I mean the sum of these momenta. So there's a propagator here, right? And there's only simple poles. There's only, you know, it's only propagators, like Feynman propagators here. Okay, so this is just elementary field theory, right? And now I wish I had another blackboard. Oh, does this go up? Oh. Okay, so this thing I've written here, I haven't introduced z. So this is unshifted. This guy, I'm writing down a formula for a, z equals zero. So let me carry out the shift. So the key is the pole, the location of the pole. So where's the pole? Where's the pole in z? Where is pole in z? Well, PAB, so you see it's this, there's a propagator here, and I want to know what it does under the shift. So it gets shifted to PA, B of Z, which is KA mu, put a little mu here, plus dot, 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 KI mu, plus dot, 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 KB mu, okay? Now this guy here shifted. Everybody else does not shift, right? Because I'm only shifting two of the legs. One of the legs that I'm shifting is this I leg. So here it is. I'm just shifting this leg here. So let me add in that shift. And that shift is minus z over 2 I minus gamma mu j minus. So I is here, j is on the other side, right? Now, where's the location of the pole? Well, the answer is I square this. So I take PAB of z squared. I set that equal to 0. So this determines the location of the pole. Okay, so that's equal to PAB squared without the z. So I really mean z equals 0. And then there's a bunch of cross terms, right? Because I'm squaring this. So if I square this, I get the square of this. That's this here. Then I get a cross term, right? And the cross term is z I minus PAB slash, okay, J minus, and then I get the square of this guy, but the square of this guy is 0. So there you have it. The location, ZAB, that's the location in the complex plane. So there's a ZAB, there's some pole sitting at this location. ZAB is equal to PAB squared divided by I minus PAB slash J minus. Okay? Now, okay, so that tells me where the pole is. How do I calculate a residue? Well, suppose I have some function. Suppose I want to know what the residue of f of x divided by x minus x0. Right, what's that residue? The answer is, I take this f of x up in the numerator, and I substitute the value at the pole. So that residue is f of x0. So that, in fact, tells us how to calculate. You see, we have the pole here, and we need the residue. The residue is given by the product of the trees, except you have to substitute the location of the pole, right, in these tree amplitudes here, which have undergone the shift. So we can write down immediately a recursion relation just based on elementary complex variable theory. We're almost out of chalk here, by the way. Okay, so the recursion relation is we have to sum over all diagrams, like so, where these are not Feynman diagrams. These are on-shell tree amplitudes, right? Off-shell physics, we banish it. We don't like it. But these are on-shell. There's a pole located here. It's now located at z minus zab. There's a pole sitting right there. And then there is, multiplying the pole, there's a product of tree amplitudes. These tree amplitudes are shifted. So there's an A, let's call it on the left side, but I'm supposed to substitute ZAB into it. On this side, there's another amplitude, let's call it the right one. And I carry out the shift, there's my shift, I and J, but again, I substitute Z equals ZAB into it. So the final recursion relation I get final recursion relation. So the final recursion relation. Is that a tree amplitude at z equals 0, right? So that's the one I'm really interested in, is equal to a sum over all channels AB, where I substitute a tree on the left, so that's a lower point amplitude, and I definitely know these because why am I computing a higher point amplitude unless I know the lower point one? So I definitely know them already. I substitute z equals ZAB. There's the unshifted guy. Actually, sorry, let me go back one step. Let me not substitute z equals 0 in just yet. So let me write down a slightly more general recursion relation. Tree, and there's the right, z equals ZAD. Okay, and this is nothing but this. See, I've got my pole, there's a single pole sitting here. Well, this is squared, by the way. There's a function up in the numerator, which is the product of these trees. But according to basic elementary complex variable theory, if I want the residue, I substitute the value of the pole in that function. And now if I want my physical amplitude, now I'll do the next step. All I have to do ZAD, and then I just substitute 0 in here. There's again my tree. There's the right amplitude, and z equals ZAB, I substitute. Okay, so I'm sure none of you understood this, so what we really need to do is work out an example. Yeah? Did I erase it? Oh, that's kind of naughty of me. It's hiding in here. So you see, ZAB, it's hiding in here, was PAB square divided by I minus gamma, PAB slash J minus. So there's a memory of that in the location of the pole. It remembers what my shift was. Right here is where the information went. Sorry, what's that? Yeah. What derivative? This is a single pole. This is the residue. Yeah, that's right. There's There's some factor that you have to be more careful with. That's true. But anyway, if you're more careful, this is what you get. Okay. It's true. There's something multiple. It's not exactly. It's true. God, you guys are too quick on me. See, there's some factor sitting in front. There's something sitting in front of this thing, and that's what you're worried about. Anyway, it's just some silly little factor. If you keep track of it, this is what you get. Ah, no. I do this all the time. So, see, this is just the pole. This is just the ordinary pole that you would find in a Feynman diagram, because it's unshifted. Yeah, I drop those squares. Yeah. No, sorry, that's just a typo. I do that once in a while. Now, two legs. Yeah, two special legs. So, in fact, there's lots of recursion relations. We're drowning in recursion relations. Yes? Then by Z. It gets, yes, that's exactly right. Yes, very good. That factor cost me a lot of time once. Yeah, that's right. It's because there's that z over there which takes care of that factor. What's that? Oh, that's what that was. Very good. Bad. You guys are efficient. Okay, so we have a choice. I can show you an example later, you know, of how you actually do this. It's a four-point example. It's, like I said, the very simplest example, or we can do it now. But I may run into the next talk or...
Well, coffee break.
Maybe later in the day, if there's a little bit of time, I'll just work out an example for you guys. You know, because you can see these formulas over and over again, but you got to see how it works in an example.
How long does it take to
do? About 15 minutes. Well, it's that always takes more time, so let's say 20 minutes. I'll just do the simplest four-point example.
We'll talk about it.
Yeah. Okay.